right, welcome to Dr. Drew Podcast. Don't forget all the usual stuff. Check out my son's podcast music. It's drdrew.com/podcastmusic. Guy's a great composer, and he's creating music for podcasts, of all things. He's a law student, so this is how he's getting through law school. It's awesome. Also, check out, click through on the banner support to be able to support us so we can keep keeping the winds and the sails of the Corolla pirate ship, and do support the people that support us. We appreciate it. It's my privilege to welcome Lori Kilmartin to the show today. Lori, welcome.
Oh, my privilege. I'm so excited.
So this is going to be fun. The book I want to get in deep on, it's called Dead People Suck, A Guide for Survivors of the Newly Departed. Lori can be seen at Laugh Boston May 31st to June 2nd, Comedy Addict in Bloomington, Indiana. Mm-hmm. There's a Bloomington, Illinois, too, right?
Yeah, it's not that one.
It's Indiana. Okay, yeah. 29th and 30th. And then your website, which is kilmartin.com, K-I-L-M-A-R-T-I-N. Twitter, you can follow her there at any Lori, L-A-U-R-E-I-E 16, L-A-U-R-I-E 16. You write on Conan now. That's a great group.
Oh, yeah. It's really fun.
Yeah. I mean, I used to do it back when they were in New York. I've sort of been through many incarnations of that organization over the years. And it was the same group that did The Tonight Show for a short period of time,
sure,
too.
Yeah.
Same guys.
Yeah.
Same folks. And just the most warmest, nicest, you know, funnest group I've ever been around.
Yeah. And nobody ever leaves the show. There's hardly any job openings.
That may be why I've followed them around. But I remember when it used to be in 30 Rock, you know, both when it was the original show.
Uh-huh.
And then the Tonight Show. No, Tonight Show was
Tonight
out here.
Tonight Show came here,
Tonight
I think,
Show was out here.
And
that's how they got out here, I think.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking of my experiences in the original show. I feel like I had some intense experiences in those little – they had these tiny little dressing rooms that
put
you in along the hallway there.
Yeah.
You must have seen that.
No, I haven't. I didn't come aboard till the TBS show. So
oh,
I missed
it was
the whole
very
30 Rock.
New York. Very New York experience. I think I was even there. I had some sort of – oh, I know what it was. This was my experience was when it must have been – he must have been 5 years into his late night show, right? And we were – the show – we were like the last guests, and I think it was God, the guy that plays Harry Potter, I think, was actually the guest.
Oh, Daniel.
Daniel, whatever
Radcliffe.
His name is.
Yes, Radcliffe.
Yeah. In any event, you might be able to find a clip or something of this. Me and Adam on Conan, long time ago, mid to late 90s. And at the end of the show, we're sort of chatting up there. And I think we sort of stood up and walked forward. And Conan goes, can you believe this? He goes, I would come here and watch David Letterman. I'd watch David Letterman in this studio. And this is my studio. I can't believe it. He was still giddy. Yeah,
that's
He was gobsmacked. This is like years in that every night he got to do something in this studio that he used to come as a college kid and watch David Letterman.
A survival guide to life and love.
Oh, my God. That's our book.
Dr. Drew Pinsky and Adam Carolla.
How crazy
Oh, my
that?
God.
Who are the other guests? Look at us.
Oh, you're my God. Everywhere. Oh, Andy, too. You guys are
so Rob
young.
Schneider? Is that who it was? Oh, he was Jerry Stiller.
Oh,
I was going to say
wow.
It might be Jerry Stiller that was in there.
And that's Rob Schneider in the middle?
I think it was
oh,
Rob Schneider
God.
In the end. Was it not? Is that right? Yeah. Rob,
wow.
I didn't remember that at all. Rob has become a good friend
Andy?
Since
what were you
that's
doing?
That's what happened. Andy.
There's no room on the couch.
Put it on the edge of the couch or something. We're right
there. There you go.
Good man.
Now, it's enough. You know, they can find it on YouTube, I'm sure. I'm going to watch the whole episode.
I've never seen that happen in
the whole appearance. I want to. Man, that's great.
Yeah. And what was even more weird, Gary, you'll appreciate this part, is after I've talked to Conan and the audience is getting up and I look out in the audience and standing up and moving towards us, I see a woman that looks like Adam's mother. Now, by the way, Adam and I had already been in multiple colleges and been around the country and we'd been on the road for like 10 days or so. And I go, geez, Adam, a woman looks like your mother. I go, oh yeah, they're here. He didn't. We're all on the other side of the country at the same time in the same room, and he didn't bother to say, oh yeah, my mom and a stepdad might show up to watch this. And they had one of their classic interactions where, what's his one? My Pat. What's her first name? I forget. Adam's mom.
Oh, Lauren's his sister.
Yeah.
His mother
Pat,
is
not Pat. Anyway, she kind of came up and went, hey, good job, and I was like, yeah. Yeah. And they just sort of parted. That was
that
it. We didn't agree to do anything with them or anything.
Chris,
oh
that's
God.
Right. We didn't agree to do anything with them or say anything. That was the end of it. That was the end of the contact we had 3,000 miles away from here. But anyway, I found that was before I got to really know Adam. Now it would make perfect sense. So you're writing on Conan. That's got to be fun.
Yeah, it's very fun.
That's good.
Yeah.
But let's get into yet another book called Shitty Mom.
Yeah.
Tell me about that one before I get
that's there. A parenting book that's full of bad but funny advice.
Give me an example.
I guess the one that is actually kind of useful in my opinion is when you have a newborn and you're trying to sleep through the night,
yeah.
Get a box fan and put it in your room and turn it on high so you don't hear the baby.
So just over – that's not terrible advice.
I agree. People run to the baby all the time. Just don't. Yeah, just get your 8 hours.
We had triplets and so
– oh, yeah. Yes, oh, yeah. That's right. Oh, my God.
The pain, the literally the squeeze I saw on your chest was a very apt sort of response.
And
yes,
true.
Inappropriate. Very appropriate. And yeah, we had to get used to screaming and yelling by the kids and just keep going.
God.
And babies use something called projective identification, which is that feeling you get when you walk in the room. You're like you get your guts go inside your chest. And that's babies sort of are able to inject their feelings into you to get action out of you.
Oh, really?
Unfortunately, when babies aren't given adequate sort of interpersonal nourishment from the parents and they become young adults and adults, they continue to use that same strategy.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Yes. And there's a lot of that going on these days.
Oh, if my you kid's ever, 11, I think.
But
I
not mean. Your kid. I'm just saying, if you're ever in a room around somebody and you get that feeling like I need to get out of here or, I'm
oh,
having,
right,
or
right.
some feeling I'm having that doesn't belong to me,
yes,
that's projective identification.
Interesting.
And they will inject their stuff into you and then manipulate it as a way of regulating their own emotions.
Oh, God. I feel like I've dated a lot of guys like that. The way you just described it, I'm like, that feels like a date to me.
They can do that. We do. There's still a lot of that going on. All right. So let's go into the current book, which is Dead People Suck. What is it about? It's available on Amazon. Why'd you write this? What are we going to get from it?
It's a book about my dad died from lung cancer and he was in hospice at my house. Pardon me?
How old was he?
He was 83.
Okay.
So it's sort of about the shock of losing a parent and the shock of being depressed about it. It's all because I was 48 when he died, and I guess I should have seen it coming. and even when he was in a hospice, I was like, no, there's no way. I know he's going to turn this around.
Oh, no.
And it's so.
Didn't the hospice people help you?
No, they didn't say anything. No one ever actually says anything. You know, the doctors say it's not looking good and we're going to bring him home to hospice. And you know, you don't want to ask, is he going to die? Because you kind of don't want to hear the truth. So you just sort of – or at least I just sort of read the best possible interpretation of everything they said.
What's your recommendation to us as caretakers? Do you rather we were more explicit or would you rather we sugarcoat it or sort of
– I would rather be more explicit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You could, if you were my patient, I would be explicit.
Right.
It drives me insane when they are not. It drives me absolutely categorically. When surgeons say things like, we got it all, I want to punch them in the face. Because there's no such thing as we got it all when it comes to cancer.
They didn't explain it well to my dad. And my dad may have had like chemo brain or something and he couldn't understand it. But he thought that they had got it all. And I just was looking at the letter
I'm sure they told him that. They tell them that.
They might have said we got this one tumor. But there were these four other ones they didn't tell him about.
They talk to you as though we got it all. Got every bit of it. No margins on that. And that's all they talk about. And
right.
I really think they should be like – there should be like a category of malpractice for that because it is unethical.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many times I've had to deconstruct things that were told by surgeons where I have to go, I'm sorry. I know they told you they got it all.
Yeah.
No. There's no such thing.
Yeah.
That does not exist. We'll do the best we can and maybe – and I'll give realistic time frames and hopefully we'll exceed that.
I didn't like the fact that I was the one explaining to my dad, I think you have something on your liver. That's what this says. I mean, I'm not a doctor. Yeah.
Now, what would you recommend if a patient says, I don't want to know anything? Just do the best you can.
The patient, I guess I would talk to it's more the family members, right?
Well, not necessarily because ultimately it's about the individual who's dying.
Right.
It's not our needs so much. It really needs to, the priority should be the individual.
Right.
The patient. The family should be considered for sure, but.
Well, I would say, what dreams do you still have? What things do you still want to do? And they would say, in my dad's case, I want to go to Bryce Canyon, visit Bryce Canyon in Utah. And I would say, you won't be able to do that. Is there something like that? And then we would just keep – I guess I would just keep downgrading until we found something. Like, you can go to the store one more time.
That's a nice actually zone for the family to stay in.
Yeah, I guess so.
You didn't feel good though, huh?
Well, I mean, death never feels good, but it was a wonderful experience in a way. You know, he had come home, so he's surrounded by, you know, everything he knew, and we just sort of escorted him to death, my sister and I. And
was there your mom? Was she around?
My mom was there as well. She was frantically cleaning the house and had a very difficult time not doing laundry. Oh. My sister and I, the night before my dad died, I think it was an oxygen machine, but it was some sort of machine he was using to get stuff out of his throat. He had lot of fluid. Yes.
Suction.
And it broke. Hmm. And we called the hospice people and they said, we'll be around soon. And they just didn't show up. And my sister and I sort of did this thing where I sat behind my dad and she was in front of him and she scooped stuff out of his mouth and I patted his back, you know, gently and to kind of loosen it up. And then we told him just all the stuff he had done for us when he was a kid and how great it was. And just like memories going back to, you know, taking us.
That sounds wonderful.
It was wonderful in a way. I mean, you know, it was his last night. So everything was falling apart. Yeah. And, he was facing my mom and my sister and he told them both, you know, I love you. And then I was behind him and I said, I love you to my face. So I want one. And so when we laid him back down and he was sort of rolled over on his side a little bit and then his jaw was locking and he kind of said, oh, I love you. You know, like it was really difficult for him to say, but he said it. And that was the last thing he said to me. Then he went to sleep, and I was like, phew, he can rest now. I really didn't think that was his last night. I thought he just had a tough night. And then the next morning, he died.
I'm not sure that was sleep he was doing.
I know. In retrospect, it was like, oh, that was a death rattle, and the breaths were like, you know, 15 seconds apart.
That's coma. That's coma.
Is it really? Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I had no idea that was coming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that wasn't good hospice care, so, by the
no,
way.
No, it wasn't.
Suboptimal. Was that out here?
It was in Northern California, in Pleasant Hill, California.
I do not recommend that hospice group.
No.
tell me about the dead people suck, the guy.
Well, it's just, you know, I'm a comedian, and I just started writing a bunch of jokes about cancer and hospice.
You were tweeting them, too, right?
I was tweeting them because that's the thing. You don't want to leave the house when someone's dying because you don't want to miss it.
Yeah.
So I just hung out with my dad and started tweeting jokes I probably would have tried that night on stage. And so people started getting interested in what was happening because of
were
that.
Were they inappropriate at any point?
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, all of them were.
They were pretty. Yeah, I should have. I can't remember all of them right now, but it was. I was sneaking off to have sex with a boyfriend at the time, and my boyfriend was African American. And at one point, I told my dad after they met for the first time, I said, "You can't die today, or people will think that you're racist." So just stuff like that. And just hospice is so – it's searing and boring, you know, and it's a million different things. And I kind of dealt with every emotion by trying to write a joke about it and getting it out and moving on to the next one quickly.
And is the Survivor's Guide sort of structured around the
jokes?
Yes.
It's a ton of just it's jokes. It's basically jokes about the entire situation. But it's also, you know, there's some real stories there too. So it's not just, you know, stand-up. So it's a little mix of both.
So tell me about your family of origin. So it's the same two parents?
Two parents, married for 55 years.
My goodness.
And dad was an engineer. He worked overseas a lot when I was a kid because he had a hard time getting work here. It was like the 70s. And I think Bechdel laid him off or laid off a bunch of people.
A lot of people were going to Saudi Arabia back then.
Saudi Arabia. Yeah. He went to the Philippines. He went to Nicaragua during the Sandinista Revolution. His resume reads like a secret CIA spy or overthrower.
Maybe he was working for the CIA. You just didn't know it.
I haven't found anything yet. I have all of his papers and I'm slowly going through them.
Yeah. But is that weird?
It's comforting. He used to write a lot of letters to companies. He would keep their correspondence. And there was one from Westinghouse that said, "Dear Mr. Kilmartin, thank you for your continuing correspondence." So I guess he was going back and forth about a washing machine. But it was just like, oh, that's so dad. So I like having that kind of dumb stuff. And, you know, letters from senators. And they all sound like they're tired of hearing from him because he wrote to everybody all the time.
Was he a mechanical engineer?
He was a civil engineer. He built dams.
Okay. Was he an Asperger's-y engineer kind of guy?
I don't know that he was Asperger-y, but he was He would anytime something interested him, he would buy two or three how-to books on it and then never finish them. Huh. So he had thousands of books on so many different subjects, and I think he got through half of one of each one of them. So he kind of knew a little bit about everything, but besides engineering, but it wasn't too deep on anything after
that. But how-to sounds very like building oriented.
Yes, yeah.
So that was what he knew a lot about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He had a lot of language books, and he knew a little bit of a lot of languages.
Did they travel?
They lived in Iran for a little while before I was born. He had a job. He's working on the Karaj Dam in Tehran.
And did you guys travel with them ever?
No, we were going to go to Nicaragua, and then the civil war broke out. And all of a sudden, my dad was being shot out in Managua.
A little dust up. Yeah. Bring my daughters down.
They're like, we're going to have to leave you there.
And did you guys go to high school and college and stuff up north?
Yes.
Where did you go to college?
I went to UCLA for a year. Mm-hmm. I dropped out. I went to Carondelet High School in Northern California. It's a Catholic girls' school.
And then that guarantees a career in comedy. How did that happen?
I was pretty depressed. I had a I was a competitive swimmer, and I was I had a coach who was a little handsy.
Oh my God. So slow down.
Okay.
So usually the competitive swimming is with mom at 5 a.m. Was it different back then?
It was with my dad. What my dad would do it when he was home between gigs. And then
but the early morning stuff.
It was not my mom. It was a friend who was a little bit older who had a car and was like 16 and could drive.
And this was a high school team.
It was an AAU team. So we swam in San Ramon, which is about 15 minutes from where
we lived.
But what
I'm getting at, usually it's a lot of parental involvement to get the kids up at 4 a.m. and get them in there and all that kind of stuff.
No, not a lot at all. In fact,
this was all you.
Yeah, it's AAU is a little different. I mean, you're swimming 4 hours a day, so you have 2 workouts. Yeah. I mean, since there was an older girl who could take us to swim practice, myself and a couple other younger swimmers, we all just carpooled together, or she drove and we paid her gas, or my parents paid her gas.
How'd you get interested in that?
I don't know. I guess when I was a kid, I joined a little rec swim team near our house, and I was decent at it, and so I got into it.
Usually that's parents directing kids that way.
No, it didn't. No, actually, I kind of...
You understand that's unusual to be all motivated by the kid.
After my dad was gone. That was a problem. He those were the only jobs he could get. Yeah. So he started working overseas when I was 12. And that's the worst age to leave a girl.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I sort of gravitated to this coach of the swim team who he's now in prison. Yeah. He was one of their first cases of swim coaches that were prosecuted. Yeah.
So
yeah.
Tell me about this.
Oh, he was sentenced to 40 years for child molestation.
One of your peers or anything or anybody you knew?
Oh, a lot of people I knew. In fact, I was one. I wasn't molested, although when I was 18, he tried to do something to me.
What did he do?
He just kind of tried to have sex with me. And even though I was 18, I was a very young 18. And
how does
the
swim coach pull that off?
He didn't do it. He didn't pull it off all the time.
But I mean, it's so weird to me. I don't understand what even their procedure. These are kids that have been trusting them for a long time.
Oh, yeah. You've known since they were 12,
says, let's
11.
Have sex,
yeah. It's like a Woody Allen kind of thing where you just see somebody grow up. And then in my case, it was like, well, she's old enough. But the ones he was prosecuted for were like a 14-year-old who ended up having an abortion. She's a friend of mine. This is all happening. Like our team was so dysfunctional. There's so much happening and no one talked about it. And we only found out later as adults, like, oh, he did that to you too. Oh my God. Like no one ever mentioned it. We just all sort of suffered silently from very similar traumas. It was
horrible.
Weird. Yeah.
If you don't want to tell me, that's fine.
It's fine.
You're being a bit evasive about what he did.
No, he called me over. I was home for Christmas. I had my freshman year at UCLA, and I was bulimic. I was a mess. I had lots going on.
Well, your dad was gone.
Yes. And so he called me over and said, I want to talk to you about the 84 Olympics, which is all I wanted to talk about. That's all I wanted. And it's weird. I mean, I wasn't that good, but I kept hoping for a miracle. Mm. I kept hoping for one of those miracle swims that sometimes people would have where they drop a ton of time and it's like, oh my God. I was like, maybe that'll happen to me. Because I was putting in the same work as Olympians were and I was swimming with them. It just wasn't me yet. Yeah. And so he called me over to talk and then he sort of just sat me down on the couch, and then he just sort of lunged on me, and I was shocked. I was so shocked because I never thought of him that way, and he was definitely like a total.
Like jumped and tried to kiss you?
Yes. And I worshipped him. Uh-oh. Luckily, his wife got fired that day, and she came home, and he jumped off me, and I was just sort of stunned, and she was upset about being fired. And
from what was she fired from?
Whatever. I forget what job she had.
These two sound like quite a pair.
She was a swimmer he groomed and married, so he knew her when she was very young and married her when she was like 18.
Oh my God.
Tons of dysfunction. And parents back in those days, that's what I mean. Like my parents, they weren't participating. No one, it was not a flag to anybody. And now you'd be like, what? It's so strange how educated we are now about that kind of stuff. But, you know, just in the 80s, nobody was at all.
Was anybody having persistent problems from what that guy did?
Oh, yes. I mean, me. And it wasn't even for me. And I wasn't even that, it wasn't even that bad, you know. But a couple of my friends, very, very horrible reactions to trauma,
of course.
You know, that really changed the course of their lives in a negative way.
Oh, bad relationships, emotional dysfunction, drug use, that all goes in there.
Yeah. Stuff like that.
And for you, what happened?
Comedy.
Yeah. Well, then I dropped out of UCLA and I didn't tie it to that. I was like, I'm not into this anymore. And I started reading these books by Jeanine Roth. She writes these books on compulsive eating. And one of them was just like, you know what? Eat whatever you want and see what happens. And I was so tired of the dance and the constant counting of calories and the getting rid of food. I was like, I don't care anymore. And I ended up just eating and eating until I gained like 60 pounds. And then I kind of topped off and I was done. And I don't think I've had like binges like that ever since. I binged the way I always was afraid I would. And then I survived it.
I think that's kind of common in bulimia. They often get big and then they kind of slow down into normal eating.
Yeah. Once they lose the obsession with the food, then it's, you know.
Well, but some of that usually needs to be filled by some sort of interpersonal health.
Yeah.
So were their relationships going well then or something?
I don't know. I'm not that great on relationships. you know, maybe one day. But I kind of threw myself in a comedy at some point. I was floundering for a little bit doing like telemarketing jobs and stuff like that. And just I felt like such a loser because I was like 3 years ago, I was, hoping to be an Olympian, you know, again, against, you know, any common sense. But still, I was still doing the work. And now I'm like 210 pounds and I'm, you know, doing sales calls for the Oakland Tribune. And I was like, what happened to me?
Did you get depressed?
Yeah.
And that's when you, again, comedy was the solution?
It wasn't. I didn't look at it as a solution right there. But when I started going to see stand up in San Francisco, in downtown San Francisco by myself, I just.
When was that?
84. 85.
So there was a big comedy scene in San Francisco in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah,
right?
The Other Cafe and the Holy City Zoo. And
yeah, and that it sort of was one of the hubs.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I remember just seeing some stand-up and just being like, oh my God, I don't know how anyone does that. And then I saw somebody who wasn't very good and I'm like, wait a minute, I could do that. If she can do it, I can do it. So I'm like the kind of person that I get motivated when someone isn't as good as me or isn't as good as I think I am. I'm never motivated by the greats. I'm always motivated by the averages.
And so how'd you characterize your comedy?
Now I guess I talk about my kid and being a single mom, but I feel like my persona is I'm a person that's trapped in a box I can't get out of. So I'm just trying to do the best. My mother lives with me. I'm taking care of her. I have an 11-year-old son. I have a day job that's pretty hours heavy.
What's that?
Conan.
Conan, yeah.
Yeah. And then, I do stand up at night I was thinking about that in a weird way. It's sort of, I'm being driven so insane that to have an outlet is making me a better comic than before when I was just like a road feature and all I had to do was do, you know, a half hour set a night and then I could do whatever I wanted on the road that day. It was I had a different attitude towards life. Now I'm like frantic and fevered.
Workaholic.
Yeah.
And did you just do something with Colin Quinn?
No, I wrote on his show for a long time.
That's what it was. Okay.
On Tough Crowd. I wrote on Adam's show too, the one he had on Comedy Central. Not that you write for Adam Carolla, but I was listed as a writer.
I did that show a couple times.
Yeah, you did. Yeah.
And Yeah, I was there when Steve-O broke the table.
Oh, my God. That was nuts. Yeah.
I remember he was backstage wasted. And I'm like, Steve, dude, you're going to have to do something someday. And he goes, when I do it, I'm going to go all the way. So don't screw with me. I'll tell you when I'm ready. And he was as good as his word. When it came time, boom, he went all the way to the mat.
Wow. That's so great.
That Steve.
Yeah.
But Colin's a great guy, too.
Oh, my God. Yeah. He's so funny.
People don't know. But funny, but great guy.
Oh, yes.
People don't
yes.
know. And the giving, you know, helps lots of people.
Definitely.
And stuff. People,
yeah, he gave me my first writing job. I wouldn't be a writer if it wasn't for Colin.
Yeah, I don't think people know how good a guy Colin Quinn is.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I whenever I see him, I'll support anything he does.
Yeah.
Well, we've been talking about 310 Nutrition for a few weeks. They are shakes that are taking the weight loss world by storm. You see it everywhere for a reason, because it apparently works, and they've been a great help to hundreds of thousands across the world. And they've got a special deal for our listeners. Go to 310nutrition.com, use Drew, D-R-E-W, at checkout, and you'll get free shipping. 310 Nutrition shakes are plant-based, loaded with protein, fiber, and natural flavors. The shakes have no sugar, no artificial sweeteners, no artificial flavors, none of the fillers and chemicals you see in most diet shakes. 310 Nutrition is so much more than just the weight loss, though. It's actually nutrition, it's protein, and it's a junk food replacement. Go to 310nutrition.com, check out their blog and their recipe pages. You'll learn more about the company there. It's crazy how something that tastes so good will actually help you lose weight. If you want to lose weight, this may be the company for you. Go to 310nutrition.com. Once again, it is 310nutrition.com, 310nutrition. It's 310nutrition.com. Again, 310nutrition.com. Use Drew at checkout, and you'll get free shipping and some great extras as well. All right, if you're looking for a car, you're probably familiar with terms like MSRP, and you don't even know what that stands for, though, right? I don't. Invoice price, list price, dealer price is just confusing, and it's meant to confuse. All you're really looking for is the price. The price actually means something. Now, here's something from True Car, which, of course, is true price. You know exactly what you pay for the car you want, including fees and accessories, so you'll get it exactly before you even get to the dealership. And, of course, you'll have locked in a price for a piece of – for actual inventory on a True Car certified dealer's lot. And True Car dealers want you to and True Car dealers will show you the true price on cars like the one you want, all from the comfort of your home or wherever you are. And how do you know if your true price is a great price? Because True Car shows you what other people paid for the car you want. And True Car certified dealers know this, so they set that true price competitively because they want your business. Again, it's actual inventory when you arrive at the dealer. So when you're ready to buy new or used, visit True Car and enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states. You have a CISO special? You had one?
I did. There's no CISO anymore.
Right.
The CISO special was about my dad. It's called 45 Jokes About My Dead Dad. And so it was just after he died, I had a bunch of jokes that I would try to do during a regular set. And, you know, people, I think, basically come to comedy clubs for dick jokes or some variation of it. And then I'd be like, so my dad died. What? It was a tough shift. So I thought, what if I just did a special and I titled it What It Is, so everyone knows going in, this is what you're going to hear.
Yeah.
And so that was the premise of it. And the whole thing was just jokes and jokes and jokes about the whole situation.
And share some of that. Can you share some of that with us? I'm so curious what that would look like.
Well, like I would talk about. It's weird to just jump into jokes, but I'll try to do it without saying.
Yeah.
I do a joke like this.
Yeah.
My dad died, and it's tough to lose a parent. It's even tougher if you were hoping to lose the other parent first. I'm not the only one who feels that way. My dad's last words to me were, ha ha, she's your problem now. And what a prophet, because she really is.
Has she been?
I mean, it's not easy to live with an 81-year-old lady.
Yes.
Mother daughters. I mean, you do everything you can to get away from your mother.
How is it your sister doesn't get it?
She bought a house with stairs in it. She was very canny. So my mom can't navigate her stair-filled house.
Maybe you could purchase one of those elevating seats that go up along the stair for her.
She has like some kind of weird bi-level house in Oregon. So there's like a little flight of stairs and then another little flight of stairs. Now we're talking two chairs.
Impossible.
Too expensive.
Oh, too,
plus my mom does babysit my kid a lot.
That's good.
Like right now.
Yeah, that's, you know, I'll tell you what, being a good grandparent can overcome a ton of parental ills.
Yes, yes.
Don't you agree with me?
Yes, and just being present also.
Just being a good grandparent.
Yeah.
My dad was a great grandfather.
Yeah.
Not so great at all. But I was like, fine.
Yeah,
it's
done.
It's all behind us. You just keep doing what you're doing here with these guys.
Oh, that's great.
And we are great. And I really felt that way. And my kids bore dividends from that.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. But there is, I think it's a mistake to overlook some of the humor around death, though, because it can help you.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
And people get weird and offended. We're offended about everything these days,
yeah.
Especially anything comedic.
Yeah.
And so I wonder if you got any pushback.
A little bit. I got – when I was tweeting, the only pushback I got was – this was really strange to me. We're two reporters from Al Jazeera. com. We're complaining about my tweets, but that was about it. I mean, I tried to keep it not too crass, you know, but just crass enough. So that's always my goal on stage.
To be crass?
To be dark and crass, but not so much where people are disgusted. It's a fine line I try to ride every night.
And are you writing specifically in terms of writing, not just the stand-up, but do you write for Conan,
yeah.
per se? Yeah. The
yeah.
monologues and stuff?
No, just the monologue, yeah.
Is it you by yourself? Or
no, there's two other writers.
Still, it's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot of news stories. But so it's a relief to be able to go up on stage and complain about my mom or my son or something like that, yeah.
You'll miss your mom when she's gone?
No.
You will.
I might.
Just from the standpoint of caretaking of your son.
Do you know what would be nice if someone could be dead for a year so that you could just
appreciate
get your
them,
space?
Appreciate
yes.
them when they come back.
And then
the,
yes.
You inevitably have that feeling like, if I could just have one more conversation, there's a couple things I need to talk to
I
him
know,
about.
That's I know.
That's the weirdest feeling of all.
Yeah.
Because when it happens, you're like, okay, I'm fine. Everything's good. And then 6 months later, you're like, don't.
I know. It was this weird thing. When my dad was dying, we realized we had a ton of stuff that I'd seen forever every day in my house, little artifacts. And I didn't know what they were, what they were from. So I'm like, what's this? And that's the long knife. That's from the Philippines. And that's from Nicaragua. And he's quickly giving me backstory. And I'm just frantically bringing him
and
objects.
And he didn't know that he was dying at the time. He didn't.
I think he kind of knew. Like, he was also not prepared for – he also thought he was going to live forever because
that's that age group, that generation. They all are that way.
Yeah. He was a Korean War vet.
It was so weird. There was such a bizarre attitude they had.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many times I've been taking care of someone your dad's age.
Yeah.
And they would get a medical illness
yeah.
in their 80s. And go, I've never had anything before. It's like, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I know you've never had anything before. Now
you're
you
lucky.
Do.
Yeah.
Of course you had nothing before because here you are 81.
Yes.
And yes, and now you have this.
Yeah.
And that was a daily thing I would hear from that particular generation.
Oh, my God.
That has died out a little bit. The upcoming generation sort of has had exposure to aging parents and understands.
Yeah.
But they still aren't preparing.
Yeah.
And they're still not realistic about it, but they're at least not so shocked. So shocked that because you got to think about it. Before probably your dad's generation, people didn't routinely live to their 80s and 90s.
Oh my God! Right,
and then all of a sudden everybody does.
Yeah,
and that's aging is a disease process at a certain point, which I'm sure you saw some of it in addition to the cancer.
Yes, yes, yeah. I mean, even before he got cancer, he was sounding elderly on the phone. I was like, oh God, no, not yet.
I know,
but isn't it something where if you live past like maybe 70, then you could easily live to be 90? But like
the
60s are the most dangerous.
Well, the
age,
longer you live, the longer you're going to higher the probability you're going to live longer.
Wow. Yeah.
In other words, if you make it to 75, then you have a higher probability of going to 90.
Wow.
But I will tell you that for men, the wheels start to come off the wagon in the mid-70s typically.
Oh.
Men just go – just starts happening in their mid-70s.
Interesting.
And they either make it through or they don't. And if they make it through, the 80s are still old but a little less unstable.
Yeah.
Like whatever they've been contending with through their 70s, now they're contending with in their 80s. There are no new surprises until some sort of terminal event, something really happens. And men in their 90s are – although these days it's a little different because people are aging better. But men in their 90s, not a happy group to be around. I know a more unhappy group than men that can't walk or in constant pain, can't pee, can't fuck, can't do anything, can't think, can't remember. They are just – and they'll let you know it. Can't see, can't taste, can't swallow.
Maybe I lost my dad at the right time. Who knows? It felt a little young still. He's walking a dog 2 hours a day.
Yeah, you would hope late 80s. You'd hope for.
Yes.
But still, that's not that big a difference.
I know. Really I do get angry when I read of like Nazis that are still alive. I'm like, you got to be kidding. There's like a 90-year-old Nazi
when it comes
that's
to
still alive.
Fair and not fair. No.
It's awful.
Uh-uh.
Yeah.
It's not. Have you yourself had any medical problems? Have you felt that not fair feeling?
No. I've been pretty lucky so far. Just all mine are mental. I mean, not mental illness, but just,
bulimia is a mental illness, but it's mental illness light.
It's something that's acute
mental illness.
It can dissipate a bit,
What's that?
the obsession with food, I think. Like, I still, you know, I'm still trying to work on enjoying a meal. I still don't like to be viewed when I'm eating. I still have still like little games I play in my head that I have to catch myself and go, this isn't how I want to die. Like, I want to be able to, you know, have a satisfying meal and have a satisfying feeling.
Maybe you should have that treatment.
There's
a treatment out there for that kind of thing.
Really?
Oh, absolutely.
But I don't know that it's enough where I need treatment, you know?
Well, it doesn't get better by itself. It sort of changes and morphs and things, but
yeah.
It's kind of a fixed thing that has a very effective treatment.
Really? What
is it? I have family members with it. It takes time. There's interpersonal ways of doing it, group ways of doing it.
Yeah.
And whatever stuff there is has to get kind of reworked, rewired.
I'm so tired of reworking things.
Yeah.
That was the thing about writing a book about it, is I did have to go back and read all these notes I wrote about my dad when he was dying and just remember all that. And, you know, I mean, flip it into jokes is just fine, but just like, oh, I'm so tired of dipping into this pond. And after I was done writing it and I had a deadline, I turned it in. I was like, I'm just going to – now my dad's memory is mine again. You know,
that's good, because I'm going to make you dip back into it again here. So I'm glad you're relieved. Here we go. Let's get back into it. So if you thought it was just going to be fun having a chat here today, I'm sorry. But seriously, what is in the book that like is difficult? What was the most difficult part?
That night was difficult.
That last night.
Yeah.
That sounds kind of beautiful.
It was in a way. It was painful to
go
through all that stuff.
Bittersweet?
No? Bittersweet's good. This wasn't really difficult. We did keep his body for a whole day. Like when he died on Sunday morning, the Oscars were that night. And so we decided to watch the Oscars with his body. And so we just sort of, you know, we had a hospital bed. We propped it up. And the three of us sat on the bed with him and we watched the Oscars. The thing is I didn't want to – we didn't want to give him to the mortuary yet because he was still pink and alive looking. And so we just – and we called the hospice people and they said, you could keep him, but you have to keep the house cold. And, you know, because you don't want him decomposing.
You understand these are some of the most stunning details.
Really?
Oh, they're fantastic.
So, yeah.
Is it in the book?
Yeah. Oh, we fantastic. Kept him overnight. And then the next morning, Monday morning, he looked very dead. You know, he looked gray. And I was like, yeah, he's gone. There's no blood anymore, it looked like.
So you were doubting that he was actually dead all through that first day.
I kept hoping he would pop back up. Because he did a couple times look like he was gone earlier in hospice and then popped back up with some sort of detail.
So nobody pronounced him dead?
My sister is a psychiatrist, so she pronounced him dead. Yeah.
That even makes it more bizarre that she is there sitting with her dead dad.
Yeah. It was kind of weird, and then Bette Midler during the in memoriam sang "The Wind Beneath My Wings," and we were all like dead.
Were you literally sitting in the same room with him?
Yeah, sitting on the hospital bed because he was, you know, when they have cancer, they die skinny, so he was very tiny, and the three of us were able to sit on his single hospital bed and just kind of curl up around him and watch the Oscars with him.
Wow.
Yeah. And then his funeral was supposed to be on the following Sunday. And so we made plans for that. And then we got bumped to Monday because somebody else died. And they said, the church said, well, this person's going to have a lot more mourners than your dad. And we can't do two of them in the same day. So we're going to move your dad to Monday.
That's weird, too.
That is very weird. I was outraged because my dad was like the last good Catholic. You know, he's the guy that wouldn't believe in, you know, the sexual abuse. Oh, come on. That's just one bad person. He didn't believe anything bad about the Catholic Church. And he gave $5 a week even during the recession in the 70s when he's broke, he gave $5 a week. He wrote a check every week. That's like the one guy the Catholic Church really should have gone all out for. And they didn't.
Should have taken him to Rome.
Yeah. And then they misspelled the Philippians on the program wrong. They spelled it a letter from Paul to the Philippines. I was like, what is wrong with you guys?
My God.
Yeah, it was a strange time.
That's that famous letter, right?
Yeah, yes. I read it. Because my dad, he couldn't articulate what he wanted at the funeral. Again, he hadn't made any plans. So he kept saying 21. So we just found a bunch of, you know, passages in the Bible that were like, you know, you know, 6:21, whatever, and any psalm or whatever that 21 in it, we Eileen and my sister and I were like, we'll read it. And then we realized afterwards he's probably referencing a 21 gun salute, which is what he wanted, which we also did, but I didn't put it together until later.
Was he in the military?
Yeah, he was in the army. He was in Korea.
Gosh.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah.
And so I'm still so fascinated by watching the Oscars with Bernie.
Yeah.
I mean, this is Dinner with Bernie, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
And what did you guys do when the Oscars ended that night?
Gosh, what's that? Like maybe 11 o'clock or something? I don't know. I don't remember. I think we just went to sleep, you know, upstairs in different rooms.
So you just said goodnight to your dad?
Yeah. Yeah, and then he came down the next morning, and you know, again, he looked like a corpse. And before, when we left, he had looked like our dad. It happened pretty quickly, but it was easier to give him to
get rid of it. Yeah,
yeah, they're going to put him in a bag and roll him out of the house, and it was easier to do when he didn't look.
So, do you feel like hanging out like that? Because I've certainly been in hospital situations where people go, I'm having trouble leaving. I didn't want to leave the body.
Yeah,
I've seen that's a common human feeling. Do you feel like you guys indulged that properly?
Oh, I loved it.
No,
I thought that was perfect. Yeah. Because, again, when we let him go, it
didn't hurt as much.
It didn't feel like he was still alive in there. You know, people that have had near-death experiences say they float above or they're still there. And so when he looked alive, it felt like he might still be hanging out with us, actually watching the Oscars with us. And then the next morning again, he just, you know.
He couldn't deny it any longer.
Yeah, he's gone. He left. He's with his brother now.
and did you have any – was the morning difficult for you, the actual morning itself? Not
M-O-U-R?
M-O-U-R, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, he was my first death, my first big death. You know, I guess a few friends have committed suicide, but this is the family altering death. That was my dad's was the first one.
Sure.
And that was, I guess, really hard to get used to. It's like, it's just my mom, me and my sister now.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's not fun anymore. You know, my dad was a fun one. And it's so, that is hard getting used to how you're, family changes a little bit. And I joke about my sister and I both hoped my dad would be free from my mom for a couple of years. We're like, oh, I know, because she's been in terrible health for 50 years. How's she still alive? I don't know. And the fact that my dad went before her is shocking.
Yeah.
She's very naggy and stuff. And we always were like, man, when he'll have a couple of years without mom and he'll just be able to walk the dog without getting yelled at. It'll be awesome. Oh. I'm like, he didn't. Dang.
Oh, well. He did the way he wanted to do it, though, right?
I guess so.
Yeah. I mean,
it's his marriage. What do I know?
Exactly.
We just look at him and we're probably extra hard on our mom because we're daughters.
Probably. and I'm thinking about your sister, the psychiatrist. Does she know you have bulimia or had it?
Yeah, I think she did too.
She also did.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she didn't suggest maybe treatment?
She went the opposite where I just like have cereal and toast at the house. I just don't want to deal with food. And she's like a practically a gourmet cook. She's a great cook. She puts it all together. She cooks. She loves cookbooks. And so we kind of have different ways of dealing
with food. Was she in the swim team too?
Yeah, but not like me.
Did she get touched by the dude?
No, she didn't know him.
She didn't even know him.
No, she knew him, but she wasn't a swimmer.
And so the eating disorder, I wonder if more about mom than the swimming.
Oh, I'm sure it is. Yeah, I mean, she used to count calories for me. That's helpful, right? I do remember I had a terrible seventh grade gym teacher who weighed all the students and then put our weights on the chalkboard.
Jesus.
And I was really tall and for in seventh grade especially, and I was kind of muscular from swimming, so I weighed almost more than all the boys except Fritz, who was like this really big kid. And I remember going, oh, I was like 5'9 and 150.
Oh.
And I was like, oh my God, this is awful. All I could see was 150.
What age were you?
Like, I think seventh grade.
Oh.
Yeah. Again, my dad was he gone? Yeah. No, he wasn't gone yet. He was leaving that summer.
Well, he had to have been gone a lot, just the number of places you said he ended up. Just counting the number of places up, let alone the time spent.
Yeah.
It's a lot of way.
A lot of places, yeah.
Oh, goodness. So it's sort of emotional, all this stuff.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's okay. I appreciated the chance to work through it. You know, it's weird. I was just working in Lake Tahoe last week at the Improv, and I was driving from Sacramento or driving towards Sacramento because I was flying out of Sacramento. And I just was like, can I just keep driving down 80 and go into my parents' house in 1993 and say hi to my dad? You know, you especially when you're driving, you feel like you could just take a different exit and go right back to a special year where everyone was alive. But obviously couldn't do that.
Does it? Is there a physical feeling associated with what you're experiencing with your dad?
I guess so. It's chest area. Yeah. Yeah.
I was just feeling it. I was feeling like somebody's sitting on my chest a little bit. Oh. And I thought, that's not how I normally feel. I just wonder if that's the feeling that you get.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, especially on my left side, strangely. I don't know if that's you or.
I guess it's just more of a.
Maybe that what he was experiencing? Maybe we all saw that.
No. I don't know. It's my dad had been one of those guys that was always worried about money, and you know, he worked every day until he was diagnosed with cancer and stuff. And he was on a speakerphone call with my cousin who said, you know what, it kind of, Ron, everything worked out okay, you know, and
in life.
His daughters are alive. He has grandchildren. His wife's alive. That they still have a house. And he kind of was like, yeah. And it felt like he could be done worrying about us, and maybe he'd never had that experience or that lift.
Where'd he grow up?
Topeka, Kansas.
What's his ethnicity?
Irish Catholic. He's 100% Irish.
Where'd he get
descent.
All that? Was they like recent Irish?
No, I'm totally into ancestry. By the way, that's a way to figure out my dad. I feel like, but he's descended on all sides from. Famine Irish.
Well, that's what I was going to say. It sounds like trauma stuff.
Does it last? Lasts a couple generations, right?
It lasts 150 years. Easy. Easy.
Wow.
Easy. Easy.
That's crazy. Easy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But certainly three generations for sure.
Wow.
Heavily.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the famine was 1890?
No, 1840s.
1840s.
Yeah.
So 150 years. There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
And so we think about humans as we recreate the traumas.
Yeah.
We either revivify them by rituals or we actually subconsciously recreate them. So it just gets transmitted down to the kids constantly. And then they recreate it. And so.
When's the famine going to leave our family?
I think it's. I
might be the last one.
Well, you could argue that the bulimia is sort of some weird reenactment of
– maybe.
Yeah.
I just would love it if my son were free.
I suspect it is. I mean, because you're sort of addressing it and looking at it and bringing it out into the open and stuff. And,
yeah.
Yeah. And it does lose its power over generations for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. But it sounds like the money thing had a bigger deal for him than the food thing.
Definitely.
But that he married somebody – to bring the food thing in. She was the food. She was the food.
What am I missing?
She was the food piece.
Food obsession.
Yeah. She was the we're not complete without money and food anxieties.
Oh, you know what's weird is my dad, I found a microcassette recorder and a tape of my dad's after, and it was just like the two days after he died, and because he used to read into it, make notes in his microcassette recorder. So I played this, and it was my dad's voice from like 83, and it was somehow it was a note to his brother. His brother had given him $40,000, and I didn't realize my parents were like destitute at that time, and my Uncle Jack basically saved our family, and it was my dad thanking my Uncle Jack, and the way he sounded, it sounded like his other option was suicide. He sounded very. He's like, I don't know what was going to happen. I don't, and I'd never actually heard him sound like that in life. So it was really shocking to listen to. It's weird. Like you worry, am I going to find porn, And instead I found this, very sad, mournful, spoken letter to his brother, who I don't know if he ever heard it. And that's why I thought, why did he leave that?
Why doesn't the brother have it?
Is
Jack
why
still
didn't
around?
He write it? No, Jack died too. But like, why would is that something you'd write with a note here? Give this to
or maybe
my
he,
brother?
Maybe
or?
He dictated it to himself. Maybe later he wrote it down.
Oh, maybe. Yeah. Oh, that's right. Of course, that's what he did because he wrote letters all the time. Mm. Wow.
What's interesting is you some of these really intense things you say. And by the way, I'm a big believer in humor as a panacea. But you laugh at stuff that's pretty intense. pretty intense stuff, you go right to laughter. It's like, woo. But thus the career.
Sure,
yeah. Why not?
Yeah.
I mean, that, what do they say? Comedy comes from pain.
Yeah, sure, sure.
Antisocial and pain, right? Isn't that the two main
I think so.
Wells That's, of comedy?
All the comics I know are antisocial and they're pains in the ass, yes.
No, in pain.
Oh, and they're also
the antisocial is the pain in the ass. Well, listen, I appreciate you spending a little time with me. What? Anything else you wanted people to know as we wrap this thing up?
Or, oh, man. Jeez.
Or where they should go or what stuff you want them to see or know about you? Or
God. I don't know.
Do you have a podcast coming? Or did I hear
I
that?
Do have a podcast with
another
female comic named Jackie Cation. And we have no guests. And we just meet every week and complain about comedy and talk about comedy. And for some reason, people that aren't comics listen to it. I don't know.
What's
it's strange.
Called?
It's called The Jackie and Lori Show.
Oh, I think I've come across it. I think
no,
I've
really?
Listened to it. Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah. Good
yeah.
for you guys.
Thanks.
All right. We'll look for that. And then look for Laugh Boston, May 31st to June 2nd. Comedy Attic, Bloomington, Indiana, 29th and 30th
of
June.
Thanks for the plugs.
Yeah. And at any Lori 16 at kilmartin.com. I'm sure it's all there. So.
Yeah. And Dead People Suck is the name of the book.
Go get it. It's obviously going to be entertaining. And I mean, I'm fascinated. It's going to be fascinating. So go get it. So, and thanks for spending time with us.
Thank
appreciate
you.
It. All right. We'll see you all next time.
For call-in times and topics, follow the show on Twitter at Dr. Drew Podcast. That's D-R-D-R-E-W Podcast. The music from today's episode can be found on the swinging sounds of the Dr. Drew Podcast, now available on iTunes. And while you're there, don't forget to rate the show. The Dr. Drew Podcast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana and Gary Smith. For more information, go to drdrew.com. All conversation and information exchanged during the participation in the Dr. Drew Podcast is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only. Do not confuse this with treatment or medical advice or direction. Nothing on these podcasts supplement or supersede the relationship and direction of your medical caretakers. Although Dr. Drew is a licensed physician with specialty board certifications by the American Board of Internal Medicine and the American Board of Addiction Medicine, he is not functioning as a physician in this environment. The same applies to any professionals who may appear on the podcast or drdrew.com.
Get ultimate protection and durability for your painting project at Menards. Get a paint that combines durability and gorgeous color. Dutch Boy's DuraClean Interior Paint and Primer in 1 offers Stay Clean technology, making your home stay beautiful and clean longer. And with Dutch Boy's easy opening, smooth pouring container, transforming your home has never been easier. Save big money on Dutch Boy paints and head into Menards to get your paint project started today. Save